Okay, just the way the year has worked out, we have not had a Navi class in a while, and it works out also that next week we will not have one because next week, Wednesday, is Kristallnacht. So we'll have class now, and then we'll take yet another break, because what more do we need than more breaks? Oh, and then like 3 weeks from now we also won't have, because the night before Thanksgiving I try to take like 1 or 2 nights off just to sleep. So that's the way it works. Okay, we have been discussing Elisha. Elisha is this fascinating Navi, this fascinating prophet, and one of the major things about Elisha is that miracles is a primary issue in the tales of Elisha, right? Elisha is reviving babies and he's making Naaman's Sarat go away. He's doing all of the miracles. And Perek Vav of Melachim is not an exception. In Perek Vav, we also have Elisha doing miracles. But just to set the tone for Perek Vav, we see something very interesting. Let's begin the psukim here. Vayomru b'nei hanvi'im el Elisha. Okay? We know that there is this group of people, the b'nei hanvi'im. They are students, apprentice prophets. They are trying to learn the job. They tell Elisha, hinei naha makom asher anachnu yoshim sham lefanecha tzar mimenu. We don't have enough space. Now, why would they be saying they don't have enough space? They basically are saying that we don't have enough space. Pasuk Beis, Ne'elchana ad ha-Yardein, let's go to the Yardein. V'nichom yisham ish korah achat, v'nasalon yisham makom, l'shevet sham, v'yomer leichu. Right, let's go to the Yardein. Each one of us will take a beam, we'll build a new yeshiva, we'll hang up a sign, yeshiva for prophets. Right, it'll be amazing, it's going to be great, and right, let's do it. Why do they want to leave? Right, by the way, they probably are in Shomron until now. Shomron is the capital of Yisrael. Shomron is where Elisha had some sort of base. But why do they want to leave? So there are a few possibilities, because there's always many possibilities. One possibility is simply they want to leave because city life is not good if you are apprenticing to be a prophet. If I want to be a Navi LaHashem, so what do I have to do? I have to sit there and I have to shuckle, I have to grow my beard long, and I have to separate myself from the entire world. And if I am in the capital of Shomron, right, it's too hopping, right? There's too much going on. That's the way the Malbim takes it. The Malbim basically says that they want to move because they want out. Now, what's interesting to note, right, his Pasuk Gimel says, Vayomer ha'echad ho'elna v'leichet avadecha v'yomer eni eleich. One of them says to Elisha, why don't you join us? In other words, apparently, they want to move out of Shomron, they want to move to the Yardein and build this new town, and Elisha says, I don't want to go. And they tell Elisha, please, please, come. Rebbe, come with us, no? Why would Elisha not want to go, according to the Malbim's explanation?
I would assume the purpose of a Navi is to be where the people are at.
Especially, we're talking about a Navi Elisha, whose entire Nevuah is modeled after being different than Eliyahu. Remember, Eliyahu HaNavi is this fiery individual who ain't too interested in people, right? Elisha wants to be with people. So Elisha says, I hear what you're saying, guys. You want to move out of town, you want this, you know. Apparently, Rev. Aaron Cutler chose Lakewood as the place for the yeshiva because it was a community on a lake that was really quiet, and he didn't want anything to be going on.
Gateshead.
Gateshead is right. Gateshead is in the middle of nowhere. Correct. Right. There is something to it, by the way. Yeah. There is something to it, and that's what the students wanted. But Elisha said, "That's not my approach. My approach is that Elisha viewed himself like he's a navi for the king." And you gotta be near the king in order to give nevuah. If you are far away, just coming in occasionally, it don't work. So that is one approach. Now, Rashi has a different approach to Judaism. Right? Let's look at the first Rashi here. Vayomru b'nei ha-nevi'im. Right? Nisim shena'asu lo mesader v'holeich. The miracles that happened to Elisha we're telling about and we're continuing. Rabboseinu amru mikan, shahaya gechazi docheh ha-talmidim melofanav. Kishen nitrad, ba'u talmidim rabim v'nidcha kamakom mehem. Okay, what's Rashi saying? Rashi's saying like this. The previous episode, right before Perek Vav, is Perek Hay. Now, this is an amazing thing. People don't realize that, like, chapter 5 comes right before chapter 6. Now, at the end of chapter 5 in Malachim, right, you have the time when Elisha finally tells Gehazi, get lost. No?
Yeah.
Because after Naaman was healed, Naaman wanted to give a gift to Elisha. Elisha says, don't give me no gift. Right? And then Gehazi chases after Naaman, and he says, oh, we have two little students that just joined, can we please have some gift? Right? And, right, he kept it for himself. Gehazi is a money-grubbing individual.
It's to monetize everything.
He wanted the cash. He wanted the gifts. So now what happens is, Elisha tells Gehazi, get lost. Right when Elisha kicks Gehazi out, suddenly there's an influx of students. Right? Suddenly the school's enrollment goes up through the roof. How did this happen? Why did this happen? Because what? So one approach is that the people, if I understand you correctly, the people said, you know what, now we have a chance of succeeding Elisha. Right, when Gehazi was here, they had no chance of succeeding Elisha. That would, I think, be a very negative take on the situation. That's like reading something a bit nefarious into them. The other approach might be, and this is what most Mefarshim, the way most Mefarshim take it, Gehazi was seen as a bad influence. No one wanted to be around Gehazi. There's a few people, the Rebbe Elisha is amazing. But a lot of people said, I don't want to go to the yeshiva because Gehazi is there. No? We had something like this at the beginning of Sefer Shmuel. We spoke about this in Rosh Hashanah. Eli is awesome. But people don't want to come to the Mishkan of Shiloh and to learn from Eli because Eli has two little deplorables, to use a term from common political parlance, right? He has two little deplorables hanging out over there named Chofni and Pinchas, and no one wants to go and be Ola Regel. The only one who's Ola Regel at that time is Elkanah. Very few people are going, not because they didn't realize that Eli is amazing. He's a great Kohen Gadol. He's awesome, right? Shofei Kohen Gadol, he's amazing. But Chofni and Pinchas are scaring people away. Gehazi, apparently, is scaring people away from the court of Elisha. So people didn't want to come. Suddenly Gehazi is gone, everyone comes. Now, of course, this begs the question, why did Elisha keep Gehazi for so long?
That's a good question.
So, not simple to answer. I saw in Alex Israel's, it's not published as a book yet, but you can get it online, in his Shiurim on Malachim Bet. So, he points out that Gehazi was the type of person who had really good influence with the king. Right? Later on in Perek Ches, so the king is asking about miracles that were done, and Gehazi is right there, and Gehazi tells the king, oh, you know, here's the woman that Elisha revived her son, etc. Gehazi apparently was politically really well connected. Perhaps Elisha, because he is the same person who doesn't view himself as just being a holy spiritual man out of society, but he wants to influence, he kept Gehazi around because Gehazi has the influence. Even though Gehazi ain't such a great fellow. Perhaps Elisha also, and we've had figures like this, were somewhat blinded to Gehazi and his not fully upstanding tactics. Unclear. But the fact is, Gehazi leaves, and suddenly you have tons of people who want to join. Point one. Point two. The Yerushalmi writes that Gehazi never was really a student of Elisha. You see, usually students go into the classroom. I think this is, some of my kids, I have to convince them of this. But so usually students go into a classroom. Gehazi used to always stand right outside. The Yerushalmi in Sanhedrin says Gehazi was a huge Talmud Chacham, and he knew everything that Elisha was saying.
So why is he standing there at all?
So apparently he wanted the relationship with Elisha, and they had some symbiotic relationship, like we're saying. I don't know. But he's staying outside. Now, people didn't come to study by Elisha, because if you see the student outside, the main student, the biggest genius, is outside, so why would you go inside to learn? I saw in the Sefer Musar HaNeviim, he pointed out that it's very important to attend, even if you're a huge Talmud Chacham, but if you attend a class of someone else, the influence that you could have on everybody. I have to admit, when I was a student in yeshiva, I'm fairly certain it still goes on. One of the nicest things is that whenever Rabbi Schechter would be around for Shabbos, he would go and listen to the shiurim of whichever Rebbe was speaking. And I remember, it was probably my first year in yeshiva, Rabbi Simon gave some shiur, and he was saying all this Chassidish Torah, and I went over to Rav Schechter after to ask him, because I never heard of any of the books that Rabbi Simon quoted, and Rav Schechter was he's such a big Talmud Chacham, he quotes these books I never heard of. Now, but that's a beautiful thing on a certain level. It's a very beautiful thing, because if I see the senior person, as it were, sitting and listening to the class, right, that gets everybody else to say, Rav Schechter every year comes, most Rebbeim in yeshiva, we don't have a very good culture of this. The culture in YU needs some improvement, but part of the culture in YU is that no one listens to anyone else, generally. And it's very rare, you can give a public shiur and no one's going to come. None of the other teachers will come. Rav Schechter generally comes, when other people speak, if he can do it. It's to his credit. I think it's very impressive. Yes?
I had a professor in Antioch, years ago, who did that also, and he was an example. I still remember the guy. He was a physics professor, but somebody was giving an interesting lecture on biology.
It makes a real impression.
He would show up, Ali Val came to that lecture, I better go too.
Right. So, Gehazi does not go into class. That actually keeps people away. Now that Gehazi is gone, suddenly the students come to Elisha and say, we don't have enough space. Okay. Now, they decide to go to this other area. Again, it might not be completely different than what the Malbim said, that they want a rustic area to be separated from society. But they decide to go back to Yardane. Now, Yardane is an interesting area. Yardane is the area where Elisha came from. The first miracle of Elisha is right after Eliyahu goes up, Elisha splits the Yardane. No? Elisha came from that area. Perhaps they are saying, let's go back to where you came from, Elisha. And Elisha says, I don't really want to go back where I came from. I want to move forward. I want to move on. Perhaps that's part of the discussion over here, but like everything, we're just making suggestions. So now, then Elisha ends up going with them, Pasuk Daled. He goes with them, they come to the Yardane, Vayigzeru ha'itzim, and they cut wood. Vayihi ha'echad ma'pil ha'korah, Pasuk Hey. One of them is knocking down the beam, Ve'et ha'barzel nafal al hamayim, and the head of the axe falls into the water. Vayitzak vayomer aha Adoni vahu Sha'ol. He screams out, "Oh, alas, my master." In other words, he screams out to Elisha, "It is a borrowed axe." Now, when you think about this, on a certain level, would you ever go to your teacher and say, "You know, I lost my pen"?
Well, it's more than a pen.
It's an axe. I lost my axe. Right? Now, apparently, the type of institution that this yeshiva of the Nevi'im was the type of place that the teacher, that Elisha, was involved in the nitty-gritty details, or they felt he could help them with nitty-gritty things. I lost my axe, I'm going to go to Elisha, and I'm going to say, I lost my axe. Now, why would someone be upset that they lost their axe? He said it's borrowed. Okay. You can't work without it. Good. But he says it's borrowed. Why is he saying it's borrowed? So we can interpret this in a very positive way. You see, I could be upset that I lose something because I lost something and I'm a few dollars down. If it's something that's borrowed and I'm upset, my disturbance might be because you're missing out. It's really your axe, and I feel terrible that I can't give you your axe back. That is a very moral type of statement, no? And in some ways, this, I think, tells us the type of students that the B'nai HaNevi'im are, and this is what impels Elisha to try to do a miracle. So Elisha says, "Oh, ana nafal pasuk vav. Where did it fall? Vayar'eu et hamakom. He showed him the place. Vayiktzav esh vayashlach shama vayatzav habarzel." So Elisha goes. He cuts down his own piece of wood. He throws it into the water, and the barzel comes up. Vayomer, he says, "Harem locha vayishlach yado vayikachem." He says, "Pick it up." And this guy reaches out his hand, and he gets the axe. So here we have a miracle of an axe. And what I would say is, big whoop. No? Why? Who cares?
Well, there must be some reason for this story being here.
Well, that's what we're asking. So, I think we pointed out some possible reasons. It's like a moral thing. But why is Elisha doing a miracle for an axe? Right? What is supposed to be accomplished?
Well, it's to relieve the distress of the guy who's worried about
okay.
returning the axe to the guy he borrowed it from.
Okay. Before we get to that, let's just try to understand the details of what was this miracle. So, the Radak is already bothered by the following question. The head of the axe falls off. The metal part of the axe falls off. That means that you still have the wooden part, no? If you need to do a miracle to get the metal up, so take the regular handle, the old handle of the axe, throw it in and have the metal come up. That's not what Elisha does. He cuts a new handle, right? And that's what the pasuk says.
The
yiktsav of eight.
The head'll slip off, but again.
Right.
I'm trying.
I have to admit that I am not particularly skilled with axe. Apparently, the Times had some articles like a new sport now, like axe throwing, and stay very far away from those people.
Yeah.
Right? Lumberjacks. Huh?
Yeah.
Not a tomahawk. Tomahawks?
Yeah.
They throw axes. It's like a thing. I don't get it.
Lumberjack competition.
So what's going on here? What's going on with this axe? What exactly is the miracle? So the Malbim over here has like an essay. I give you the Malbim on the last page. Here, first of all, let's do the Radak first. Then we'll do the Malbim. The Radak on page 2. Vayiktzav Eish. So Radak asks, "Lama lo hishlach sham eitz shahaya yad habarzel mitzchila? Lama hutzach liktzav eitz? Why does he have to cut down a new piece of wood? He could just throw the old handle. Apparently, it wasn't broken. Apparently not.
V'nireh
Ki hanisim b'davar chadash yi'asu. Says the Radak, a principle of miracles is that miracles happen with new stuff, not with old stuff. Therefore, v'chein slochit chadasha. Right? In other words, when they had the story with the Isha ha Shunamit and she needed to feed her son, right? So take a new barrel of oil. Each keep on borrowing containers. Right? You don't just have the same container and refill it. Everything has to be new. Because there's some rule of miracles, says the Radak, that miracles have to happen with new stuff. I haven't got the foggiest idea why this would be true.
Where did he get that?
He made it up. He's bothered by this question, right? Why did Elisha have to do this? And he says, okay, I have an answer. The answer is, miracles require something new. I don't know. I've never done miracles. So I don't know. Now, the Ralbag over here has a theory that he had to cut a new piece of wood because the handle was very heavy. An axe handle usually is very heavy. And if you throw a heavy axe handle into the water, it would sink. What Elisha needed is something that's light enough that you could throw into the water, could catch the metal while it's in the water, and then float back up. So he needed a new handle, a light handle, and the miracle, says the Ralbag, is that he was able to have such good aim that he could throw this axe handle right into the right place on the metal of the axe. That's a miracle. Quotes Ralbag. Comes along the Malbim, and he says, Ralbag, you're too much of a rationalist. You're trying to come up with rational explanations for the miracle, and, says the Malbim, also, you can't read Hebrew. Right? Because the Pasuk says, Vayotzef habarzel, pasuk vav, that the iron floated up. It does not say that the eights and the barzel floated up. Only the iron floated. According to the Ralbag's explanation, right? This is almost one of those things called like a boomerang.
Yeah.
It's like the equivalent of throwing a boomerang into the water, getting it to come back up. It's a good trick. It's a something from the movies. But so the Ral. So the what's it called? So the Malbim says that he doesn't like the Ralbag's explanation. Now, in terms of why this miracle is here, I'm not sure. But I do think that part of the miracles of Elisha is to show that miracles are here to help average people, students, get average stuff. We had miracles before with like the the stuff that didn't taste good. What was it like? They picked some like some dates that didn't taste good. Right, so you threw stuff in and it made it. There's a certain type of miracle that Elisha's doing that does not seem to be world class, and that's precisely the point of Elisha, who is a miracle worker, who is among society, who is helping people with their daily needs. By the way, if I would say that Elisha is similar to the Hasidic concept of a Rebbe, right? It's very similar, right? Again, we're Litvax, or if we're not Litvax, we are Litvax, right? The reality is, by Hasidim, you go to the Rebbe because Rebbe Nebuch, my cow, is sick. And the Rebbe says, oh, I feel so bad for you, let me daven, right? If it's a bad Rebbe, he says, pay me enough money and I'll daven. Right? But the fact is...
what does he say?
Huh? Whatever.
You want to tell us? No.
But the fact is that this is the type of model, the Hasidish Rebbe model is very similar to Elisha, in terms of helping people with their needs, helping the Talmidim, the Bnei HaNevi'im, helping the Hasidim. Right, it seems to be very similar. Okay, let's talk about the other role of Elisha, which is Elisha is also someone who's close to the king. And Elisha also gives the king advice. Actually, there's one more point I wanted to make about miracles of Elisha, which I didn't make yet. Let me say it now. The point is like this, and this is a point that Alex Israel makes. After Elisha throws the stick in and the iron of the axe comes up, Elisha tells him, reach out your hand and take it. Elisha does not do the entire miracle by himself. He has someone else help him. Elisha revives the boy, but he doesn't pick the boy up by himself. He tells the mother, right, you take your son. No? Elisha, when this woman has no money to pay her creditors, so Elisha says, pour the oil, and then you'll sell the oil and you'll get money. Elisha's type of miracle always involves that the recipient of the miracle does something. Now, again, if you view Elisha like he is a teacher of prophecy, the way you teach people is, right, don't just watch what I do, get involved somewhat. Right? Obviously, you don't yet know how to do the miracles yourself, you don't yet know all of the things I know, but do something. Because that is the type of education Elisha's offering. Okay, let's go on. Pasuk Ches, right, the story over here is that the king of Aram is fighting against Yisrael, and he gives his servants a message to say, O makom ploni almoni tachanoti. Right, he says, you know what, we're going to camp against the kingdom of Israel, we'll have a war, and go to this and this secret place, and that's where we will, right, camp against Yisrael. Ploni almoni, Rashi writes, I think I give you the Rashi on the next slide, Rashi writes, it is a hidden place, etc. This is a top secret mission. This is our place. Fine. Now, Vayishlach Yishal Elokim Melech Yisrael Eimar, Hisham Me'avar HaMakom Hazeh, Kisham Aram Nechitim. Elisha somehow figures out where it is, and Elisha sends a message to King Yisrael, don't go there. That's where they are trying to ambush you. Don't go to that area. Right? Melech Yisrael. He warned Pharaoh, don't go there many times, and Aram is getting very upset. In other words, Aram is like planning all these sabotage missions, right? They're hiding out in different areas to get Yisrael, and wherever they're hiding out, the Jews don't come. And the king of Aram says, what's going on here? Who's the traitor? Who is telling the king of Yisrael where we plan on camping? Because there ain't no way you could know if not for the fact that there's somebody who is giving out this information. So the servant says, by the way, servants played a major role in the Naaman story also, right? It was a servant girl who tells him about, oh, there's someone named Elisha. Right? We spoke about this in the context of the power imbalance. The whole Naaman story is about who is really in charge, right? So the servant says, oh no, king. It's really this prophet named Elisha who's telling the king of Yisrael all the stuff that you say in secret. Apparently there is this prophet Elisha and he knows everything that you say. And that's it. Now, the king says, "Vayom elochu reu echoku ve'eshlach ve'kachehu v'yugad lo limar hinei bedotan." So he says, "Oh, tell me where he is, and I'm going to get him." Now, this makes no sense. If you have this individual who's a prophet who knows every single thing that you say, right? So what happens? So you say, "Oh, where is he? He's in Dotan." And where am I going to go? I'm going to go and get him. Like you don't think he's going to know what you're going to do? He's going to outsmart you. Right? What is going on here? So the Malbim raises this question. The Dat Mikra Tanakh, by the way, takes it that he really felt that if I have a big enough force, I could get him. Sometimes people are so taken with their own power that they say, oh yeah, sure, he knows everything I plan on doing, but I'm still going to get him. Okay. That's the way Dat Mikra takes it. But the Malbim has a different take. The Malbim says that when they send for Elisha, what they're really sending for is not to capture Elisha, but to give Elisha rewards. The king of Aram feels, you know what, this Elisha guy, he's really good at, you know, information. He's really good at knowing what's going on. I'm going to get him over to my side. And therefore, find out where he is, and I will give him a good gift, a huge gift. And that will bring him over to our side. And also find out where he lives, because I have to know, says the Malbim, his lifestyle. Is he somebody who gets by on $100,000 a year, that I have to give him, right? Whatever. Is he somebody who gets by, hey, what's his lifestyle? Based on the way he lives, based on his lifestyle, I can determine the type of gift that I should give. So they send, Vayishlach Shama, Susim Varecha B'chayu Kaveh V'yavo Laila V'yikifa La'ir. They sent horses and chariots to surround the city. And Elisha's servant wakes up, and he's scared to death. And basically, the king of Aram sends this huge army to Elisha, not necessarily, says the Malbim, to capture Elisha, but he's sending this group to find out what's going on with Elisha, to give him a big gift. So the servant of Elisha, the Mishareit Yishalakim, gets up, and he sees that there's this huge army around, and he's really scared. And he says, Aha, Adoni, Echon Naaseh, what should we do? So Elisha says, don't be scared. Vayomer al tira, ki rabim asher yitanu me'asher otam. We have a larger group than they have. Now, he sees chariots and horses, this whole army coming, and Elisha says, we have more than they have. And then Elisha davens, Pasuk Yud Zayin, Vayomer Hashem, pekach nas einav, v'yir'er, v'yifkach Hashem es einei hanar, v'yar, v'nei ha'har malei susim, v'rechev eish, svivot Elisha. He sees that there are all of these horses and chariots and they're surrounding Elisha. Now, effectively, what is going on over here is really interesting. The Na'ar, the Misharet of Elisha, says, I'm scared. Elisha says, don't be scared. There are more people with us than with them. And suddenly he opens his eyes and he sees, oh my gosh! Right? And they have all these chariots and fire and everything around Elisha. Right? There's like a parallelism in Pasuk Tesvav, the army, the chayot is Saviv La'ir, but now it's Saviv Elisha. Right? There's a parallelism in terms of that. Hashem opens his eyes and he sees this. So now he's not scared anymore. That's the story. Then the Navi continues. And then this group comes down to Elisha, and Elisha dives to Hashem. Elisha says, "Oh, hachnas hagoy hazavasan verim, make them all blind." And they all become blind. And then Elisha says, "Oh, this is the wrong town. Follow me." Right? So he has this whole blind army of Aram, and they follow him, and he takes them into Shomron. When they come to Shomron, so then Elisha dives. Says, Hashem, open up their eyes. And they see, they open their eyes, and they say, oh my gosh, we're in the middle of Shomron. And the king, then the king of Israel says, oh, should we kill these people? So Elisha says, don't kill them, etc. We'll talk about that in 5 minutes. Now, effectively, this is an unbelievable story. You have this army who's coming to Elisha. You have this guy who's really scared. Elisha says, don't be scared, there's an army with us. He sees the army, right? And then the way they ultimately get the army of Aram is by making them blind. So the whole thing about seeing this army, right, that the Misharet of Elisha sees this army, that whole thing has no purpose. Right? Ultimately, Aram lost because they went blind. If they lost because they go blind, why did you need this miracle of... So now, there are two reasons. One reason is Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, in one of his Musar Shmuzes, points out that God only does miracles to those who really believe in Him. God could not do a miracle for Elisha if Elisha's right-hand man doesn't really believe. If he's really scared, God can't do a miracle. You need bitachon. That's his approach. Okay, nice. It's a nice approach. The other approach, though, which is what Alex Israel develops, is based on a certain parallelism. Right? Remember, what happened to Elisha's Masharet? He begins to see. What happened to the people in Aram, to their soldiers? They get blind. Right? The basic idea is, and we point out the parallelism that the soldiers around the city, the soldiers around Elisha, where is the real power? Is the real power spiritual power surrounding Elisha? Is the real power physical power surrounding them? What's the real vision? Is the real vision of like whatever fighter planes you have? Is the real vision like the spiritual power? That's the issue that's going on, and that's why it's set up this way, I think, to highlight again the weakness of believing in physical strength. Now, the end of this parak is really interesting. The soldiers end up in Shomron. The king of Yisrael turns to Elisha, and he says, Ha'akeh akeh avi. Should I kill them, my father? First of all, using the expression, my father, is an expression of love, an expression of deference. This means that the tables have completely turned, no? The king of Yisrael is considering Elisha my father. That's point one. Then Elisha says, "Vayomer lo takeh, ha'asher shavita b'char b'cha u'b'kashtecha atamakeh. Do you hit those who you captured? Instead, simlechem v'mayim lefnehem, v'yochlu v'yishtu v'yochlu el adonehem." Right? Instead, don't hit them, don't destroy them, don't kill them. Give them food. And that's what happens. They give them a big meal. They eat, they drink, they send them away. V'lo yasvu od gedudei Aram lavo be'eretz Yisrael. Now, if you are an anti-war pacifist, this is perfect. You have an army. They're about to attack you. What do? Give them food. Right? Don't make war. Don't kill your enemies. Feed your enemies. And when you feed your enemies, they don't attack you. That's a correct read of the story, no? That's what's going on. But what's more interesting over here is, why does Elisha say not to kill them? The king of Yisrael says, I have an Aram army, let me kill them. Elisha says, don't do it. Why not? So there are, again, two explanations. One explanation is, you only have a right to kill in self-defense. In a wartime, you can kill. They're about to kill you. Ha'asher shavita b'charbeka b'kashtecha tamakeh. You're going to kill those who you captured? You're not allowed to kill captives, says Rashi. This is what we call the Geneva Convention, no? Long before the Geneva Convention. The idea over here is that you can't kill them because they are not out to get you anymore. That's a very moral idea that the Navi is driving at. It's way ahead of its time. That's one explanation. The other explanation is frumer, as it were. The other explanation says, you know what? Hashem did all the work over here. This is a miraculous war type of situation. If Hashem did it, let Hashem take care of them. You don't get involved. You didn't do anything in this war. You don't kill them. This is all miraculous. They go blind, therefore you don't kill. But the first explanation that we gave, which is found in Rashi, that first explanation says, you know what? You can't kill people unless they're out to kill you. We did not finish Perek Vav because I left the last couple of psukim Perek Vav to do together Perek Zayin. But again, it won't be next week. It'll be 2 weeks from now. And thank you for listening.